I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Tim Shiggle. Tim is the CEO and chairman of ShareThis. You're also the founder of ShareThis. And Tim, you're currently now going to run Centrifuge's Fund of Funds, a brand new private equity company that's going to help attract equity to our region to assist startups to grow and add jobs. But first, let's talk about ShareThis. How did you come up with that concept?
It became more and more apparent. I was at a venture firm investing in a variety of companies in the media space online. And it was becoming clear that search was a major factor in how media dollars were spent and how we spent time online to organize information. But there's so much information online that the issue now is what information can I trust and what information is most relevant? And what I discovered was people find out the most trusted and relevant information through sharing. And the insight was that nobody measured it. It just simply wasn't tracked. I called a bunch of research companies and nobody knew or could tell me on a monthly basis how many people shared content and what percent of a website's traffic comes from sharing. It was one of those stupid, silly ideas because I'd say, I want to be a sharing company. People would say, you mean like copy and paste? I'd say, exactly. It was just seemed so simple, but I knew from my own gut in terms of what I do every day, I'd share stories with people or I'd read stories that people send me. And I knew they were trusted and relevant. That has to be valuable. Mm-hmm. And that basically is what marketers would consider the holy grail, which is word of mouth. But the difference is online, you can track it. Whereas in the telephones, you couldn't. Intuitively, it just felt right. It felt right because it wasn't a tech thing necessarily. Everybody shares. Mm-hmm. People did it with newspaper clippings before the internet, right?
And especially you mentioned from trusted sources. So again, it's all about the relationship of one person providing content to another person.
Right. Just take an example. I might share with you a web page and you might also find that on search. But if I sent it to you, you're going to take more time to understand
sure.
it, right? Because you knew I sent it to you. So we got the domain, ShareThis. We wanted to be the Switzerland of sharing. We knew that there would be Facebook and that there would be email and there would be Twitter and there would be something else that would come along. And people share in a variety of different ways. We wanted to be agnostic in terms of how they shared and had developed this symbol that's now become basically the universal symbol for sharing.
Which looks like a little sideways V.
Yeah, a little like greater than sign mm-hmm. With three little dots. So the idea is one person sharing to two other people.
That was started when?
We launched that in August 2007.
And how many documents, pages, whatever, are shared now on a monthly basis?
We just crossed the 2 million domain mark. And we're still growing. It's accelerating. So we get something north of 50,000 new domains sign up every month.
Unbelievable.
Which is just mind-boggling. We reach about 670 million people. We reach more people in the U.S. than any other company. We surpass Google, so over 95% of the web.
So you have created this startup company, which has now grown into a successful company. You have firsthand experience of what it felt like to be one of those entrepreneurs, one of those startups who may have needed capital. And yet, here we are, fast forward, you're getting ready to manage a brand new fund of funds for startups right here in the Cincinnati region. And if folks would like to get in touch with you, though, what is your contact information?
Tim@ShareThis.com and now Tim@Centrifuge.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Tim Shiggle. Tim is the founder and chair of ShareThis. And more recently, Tim, you've become the head of the fund of funds here in Cincinnati called Centrifuge. And maybe you can share with us a little bit about what your goals are at Centrifuge, what you really hope to accomplish with this venture fund.
Centrifuge is a new entity that was conceived by some of the business leaders here in Cincinnati to address some of the key challenges we have to promote more growth and innovation in the region. It was recognized that there are a lot of great assets here, from healthcare to consumer understanding and market research. And the idea was that, first of all, we have a lot of assets that aren't necessarily tied together and coordinated. And so one objective of Centrifuge is to help with that coordination, to be a facilitator of connections, not to replicate what's already being done in terms of angel investors or incubators, but to bring them together and help entrepreneurs navigate that and also help investors navigate it and make sure that investors across the country and globally understand how to access that talent and the expertise here in the area. So along with that coordination, it was also seen that it was important to bring in more capital. And the term fund of funds is probably something that's too much industry vernacular. What it really means is we're going to invest in other funds, other venture funds, both in the region as well as outside the region throughout the U.S. to encourage them to take a strong look at companies in Cincinnati and the region. It's a very open approach. We're not drawing lines according to any specific geography, but we want to encourage those investors to invest here so that we leverage the dollars that are already here.
And you know, Tim, you are very much, in my mind, uniquely positioned to take on this role. You were with a venture fund. You also started a very successful company called Share This, which many of us use every day. So what is your goal? What would you like to see? And why did you take this job, I guess I should say? What's your goal there?
First of all, I always like an exciting challenge. But also, I've always believed that it was responsibility of entrepreneurs to give back, you know, to pay it forward. And like people like Tony Shipley, who started Queen City Angels, I have plenty of meetings on the weekends and coffee shops with entrepreneurs who are looking for advice. I saw this as a great way for me to do that at a much larger scale, to be more helpful, to connect those people with sources of capital and vice versa. And because of my background, both on the venture side and the entrepreneur side, it did seem to suit me fairly mm-hmm. well.
And you know, Tim, I know that when you had started Share This, the resources here in our region to really help your company grow at an accelerated pace, you needed to actually go elsewhere to find some of those resources. Why do you think that Cincinnati is really positioned well now to bring on the whole entrepreneurial space in terms of helping startup companies grow?
Having now been on the West Coast, and we have offices in Palo Alto and New York. I have an apartment in Palo Alto. So I get to see what we have. And we have nothing to be ashamed of. We can be very proud of the capabilities we have. We have world-class talent, world-class expertise
here in Cincinnati
region. We need to brag about it a little bit more, right? We need to let the world know that, hey, you can do that here. You don't have to be on the coast. The other thing that I came away with is, it's, you know, to use the Cincinnati Bridges analogy, we don't have to necessarily compete with them. We can build bridges. We can have offices there and here.
Sure.
We can tie it in and make sure that when it comes to things like Children's Hospital, who's ranked number 2 in pediatrics research, if you're going to do anything in pediatrics research, do it here. There are a lot of good reasons for companies to be here. I think building those bridges is really important.
If folks would like to get in touch with you, Tim, what is your contact information?
Tim@sharethis.com or now Tim@centrifuge.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, we're advising our clients very frequently to take a look at their costs, look at how they can save money, make more money, where can efficiencies be gained. And certainly one of the concepts that we think every business should really have their arms around is their break-even point.
Well, that's very important. And I think particularly in the early years of a business when they may be struggling to attain the right revenue levels for them. But you have to know what your break-even point is, because that's the target you have to hit every month and then hopefully exceed that target. And your break-even point's not all that difficult to compute, but you have to look at your fixed costs, those costs that are there regardless of whether you have revenue or not. And then there's your variable costs, which would be those costs that are caused by whatever it is you're selling, you know, the cost of what you're selling or the incremental labor cost in delivering a service, whatever that is, that's your variable cost. But you need to know how much you need in revenue each month in order to get your profit to zero.
And you also need to know how much it costs you to make a product or costs you to deliver a service, because we often see when business owners and people in organizations just misprice their product or service. They actually don't know what it costs to make a product. And unless you know that, then you cannot possibly be successful in your business in the long term.
Well, it's hard to make good business decisions. You know, you don't know whether it makes sense to add a expensive piece of machinery or an expensive person if you don't know how that's going to impact your bottom line. So you have to know, okay, if my break-even point is X and I add this much in cost, well, then it's X plus Y.
And certainly you can't forget about the overhead, the rent, the utilities, management overhead. Those costs have to be factored in as well. So the key is to put a projection together, take a look at where you see your sales over a period of time, what your expenses are, and then come down to your profit, hopefully profit or loss, in running the projection. So you can get your arms around where you stand.
Yeah, and your goal is going to be hit that break-even point early in the month, and then you have a good month because you'll be making money the rest of the month.
People who don't understand finances and really don't take the time to look at this aspect of their business because they're so focused on sales, they don't really know how to move from sales mode into really making sure that they're successful.
And for every business, there are certain indicators as to whether or not you're going to be successful. You know, most people track sales by day or by month or whatever. That's obviously a pretty easy indicator to track, but there's other important ones for people usually. How many sales calls their salespeople go on. It just depends on the business.
Yes, I call those critical success factors. So what are the critical success factors that drive success in your business? And then how can you have a quick way, easy way to get a snapshot of those so that you can see you're on track? The balance sheet is also a critically important document, financial statement, that businesses should really pay attention to, because that's really where the health of the business is measured.
Well, that's true. You can make a lot of money, but if all of your income is tied up in receivables and you don't have enough cash to pay your expenses, you can get into trouble.
When you run out of cash, you're dead, regardless of how successful your business is. So the point of all this conversation is really take the time with your own business, with your own organization, perhaps it's your division, your department, and see whether or not you are as successful as you can be, and then how can you help your company be more successful. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. You know, Tom, many businesses are on the rise in terms of doing better in the economy. They're now looking to add workers, but businesses are a little shy about adding full-time employees because of all the uncertainty that exists in the economy, including how much their taxes are going to cost them, how much their health care costs are going to be for employees. So to have the workers that they need, many of these businesses are hiring independent contractors instead of employees.
You're right. I mean, independent contractors can save you money. However, you cannot have what I've heard some people refer to as a 1099 employee, meaning that they're really independent contractors. They have to actually be independent contractors, or you could be facing some substantial problems, taxes and penalties, if you treat people that should be employees as independent contractors.
And sometimes those lines are fuzzy as far as who is an employee versus who's an independent contractor. There are certain tests that you need to make sure that you can meet, as well as proper documentation that needs to be in place. So the key here is to know the rules.
And the rules aren't that clear. There's actually about 20 factors that are defined as what constitutes defining the relationship between two individuals as to whether or not it's an employee-employer relationship.
And the reason that a business might want to classify someone as an independent contractor, because they wouldn't have to withhold taxes on them. They don't have to pay the employer's share of taxes on the payments made to them. They don't have to cover them in their fringe benefit plans or health insurance if they're not a true employee. The key is really the amount of control. It really comes down to that, don't you think? The amount of control that an employer has on a particular individual performing services for the company.
That's the behavioral control. Do you control every action of the person, or do you control very little action and just reward them for results that they can do in any process that works?
So generally, if someone is paid for results, that is an indication of an independent contractor relationship versus an employee relationship. Another test is the financial control. Who's paying for all the materials, the equipment, the supplies? Who bears the risk financially of whether or not the job that the employee is doing is going to be financially burdensome to the employer or to the individual performing the service?
Well, and is the individual working exclusively for the employer, or are they working for a variety of companies?
And then the last issue is the type of relationship. You know, was the individual performing the service hired for a specific project for a particular limited time period? Are there contracts in place explaining the intention of both the worker and the employer? Are employee-type benefits provided to that individual? All of these issues need to be considered in determining whether or not a service provider or someone working for your company is going to be considered an independent contractor or an employee in the eyes of the Internal Revenue Service.
Well, the important thing is to make sure that you document all the facts. Make sure that you talk to your advisors, including your legal counsel, and make sure that if you are treating someone as an independent contract,
director, you actually have a written contract.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guests today are Dan Taberke and Steve Pendery, and these gentlemen are here representing Triad, which is the Northern Kentucky Tri-County Economic Development Corporation. And Tom and I both, as you know, are CPAs. We work with many businesses of all sizes, and some of which are startups. And you gentlemen have worked with a lot of startup entrepreneurs here in Northern Kentucky through your UpTech program. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk about that.
Our vice president of entrepreneurship, Casey Barrage, had the idea that we ought to assimilate what's going on across the country with accelerators, where you work with a lot of mentoring, a lot of seed capital, and get companies working together in the same location. So we've replicated that at One Riverfront Place in Newport, and essentially NKU's College of Informatics provides some co-op internships as well to help these companies go through about a six-month, very intense program to hone their presentation skills, to be able to go out and make sure that they can sell their product and raise the money to be financed as they go on. They all have to have a tie into the NKU College of Informatics.
And the tie meaning they graduated from there? Or
No, their business product, their service. It all has to have an informatics base to it. There are eight companies that won the competition this time out of about 65 applicants. We're actively working with President Mearns right now and maybe launching UpTech too.
Maybe you can share what informatics is.
It's a term that is all-encompassing for the convergence of data, communications, media, information technology. It permeates all sectors of business today, and the university has got it right because everybody that goes through NKU has some contact with the College of Informatics, and they need to have that as they get out into the world today.
Informatics is really not a per se degree in technology. It's really how you incorporate technology into all other fields and careers. The wonderful thing is that UpTech is basically allowing these students to actually utilize it in the real world.
Correct. There's some upper-level students that are participating in UpTech. So each UpTech company has at least one or two NKU mm-hmm. students that they work with as they develop their business plan.
How will you measure the success of this? Is it through jobs? Is it through enhancement to the economic development? How do you measure this?
When they get out of the nest and if they can fly, meaning that they are able to raise money in the world today.
Well, and ultimately, once they do raise capital, they will provide jobs, I would assume.
That's
with
correct.
That capital.
And we're very much in tune with keeping them here in Northern Kentucky when they do that.
So is that part of it? Is that part of the idea that they have committed to stay in Northern Kentucky?
Yeah, we put the top amount of money in the country, $100,000 has been made available to these young fledgling companies as they get started. And that's been matched out by the TechStars program out in Boulder, Colorado, which we helped emulate this program from.
How did you choose these companies?
They went through a rigorous process. We had judges from across the country. For example, Dell had a judge, for example. Other information technology-based companies helped participate. Procter & Gamble, for example, had a judge on the panel. And they went through a very rigorous process, used the NKU College of Informatics, the Digitorium, as their presentation platform, and panel picked these finalists.
And if folks would like information about Triad, your website is?
NorthernKentuckyUSA.com.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Stuart Aiken. Stuart is the CEO of Dunnhumby USA. And Stuart, I know that your growth has just been remarkable. What a story. From 2002, you started here in Cincinnati with four employees. You've grown that now to over 600 in 10 years. And many of your employees are younger adults. And what are you finding in them in terms of how their work ethic is, what they're looking for in a job? How important is the community and their employer's willingness to give back to the community in determining if they want to take the job?
It's fascinating. Our graduates these days, one of the first questions they ask us is, what do we do in the community and how can I be a part of that? For us, we have very much an employee-focused giving culture in that our employees decide which organizations our company will support. And then they support it through their time. The company donates time as well, and the company will donate money. But it's all driven by the employees. So what's most important to the employees? And then they go out and work in these various institutions.
Do you think that's beneficial for them? I mean, aside from the fact that it makes them feel good, do you think they learn skills there that maybe they don't get as quickly in their workplace?
Absolutely. And, you know, even working there, we have internal competitions with who can pack the most power packs at the Free Store Food Bank. And it becomes a competition. It becomes a rallying cry for what's important in the community. And this new generation coming up really wants to give of their time just as much as they want to give of their money. And it's fascinating to see how viral this becomes within an organization, mm-hmm. and inspiring to other employees around them to participate and join in.
And, you know, to learn that at a young age, as a young adult, and the lessons that they're learning and the compassion and the empathy and actually having them into the community and really seeing firsthand what's going on and how their efforts, as opposed to necessarily their dollars, can really make a difference. You mentioned the Free Store Food Bank. What are some other examples of places where your folks volunteer?
We have 40 volunteers at Euler School who will go and help teach during the day. Women Helping Women, the Drop-In Center, Ronald McDonald's House, American Cancer Society. So we have a number of charities that they go and help in. But without question, the Free Store Food Bank is the biggest one. And a good example that really coalesces our people around that is that there's 100,000 kids in the greater Cincinnati area that don't know where their next meal's coming from. There's 92 schools that we can support, and Dunhumby's just given $6,400, which will support one school for an entire year, and our people love that. And mm-hmm. my challenge to the rest of the community is, how do we get more people, more companies supporting such an incredibly important thing in our community?
It sure is, Stuart. You know, we as a smaller firm, we have an accounting firm, we actually adopt a class over at Winton Hills Academy, and it's the fourth, I think it's the fourth poorest zip code in the entire state. But those children, it just breaks your heart, doesn't it, thinking those children don't have a meal when they go home.
Absolutely.
So as a business leader and as a community, it's like our responsibility to help these people. Otherwise, how do you ever break that cycle?
That's right. And for the employees to know that they're doing that and their company supporting that in the way you are is incredibly empowering, makes you proud of your company to work for and proud of what we're doing in the community.
If people would like information about Dunhumby, your website is
www.dunhumby.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Paul Hagen. Paul is a business coach, but he's also an author. And we're talking today about Paul's book that he co-authored called The Leader's Climb. It's a business tale of rising to the new leadership challenge. And Paul, this book is very interesting because there are lots of business books out there. But this book tells a really cool story and weaves the whole business leadership discussion into a story where you really get to know the characters.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in story anyway. Even in my coaching practice, I believe we all have a story, and we get to that. It's just a great way to connect with people. We wrote it as a story, as a novel, for a reason. We wanted people to experience what we're trying to get across, not just read about it and trying to figure out how to apply it. It's a great story, great characters, great things happen, and people really relate to that.
What do you mean experience? How as a reader are you going to experience this?
Well, think about it. If I almost think about a movie. In fact, our publisher said it's written like a screenplay in a way. You want to turn the page to see what's going to happen next. In a lot of business books, you go, okay, chapter two, I got it. Chapter three, I think I'll skip that. And we all skim business books, right? It's very typical. This one, you really kind of have to stay with the story because there's so many things going on that really come to a finish at the end. And a lot of people have said, I felt very drawn through the story. I really wanted to find out what happened to these characters, what finally happened.
Well, in the story, do we find that the hero, if he's a hero, the leader, does he have certain flaws? I mean, is he like a lot of leaders where he's probably got a lot of good attributes, but maybe a few blind spots?
I wouldn't even use the word flaws. I think he's just human. You know, it's like all of us. I have so many people that say, oh my gosh, that main character, I've been that person at different times. Well-intended, talented, ambitious. The whole message of the book is, today's world, we're going too fast. We're just going too fast. And as a result, we're fighting too much and we're forcing decisions. We've lost that sense of how do you step back, slow down, reflect, and almost kind of go against the flow a little bit. I think that's a very necessary message right now to leadership. And I can tell you, it's really resonant with people. They're going, you're right.
But it's true. How do you suggest, I mean, from your standpoint now, taking your author hat on as a coach hat, what do you say to people who feel like they're just running too fast?
There are some basic disciplines. And literally, it's when you feel, kind of the blood pressure rising, right? When you feel like, I've got to make a decision. That's almost exactly the right time to stop and slow down and get that different perspective. I think a lot of it has to come, frankly, with inside to say, I'm simply not going to be a slave to everything coming at me. Now, that's what leadership's all about, is the willingness to say, I'm going to have the guts to slow down and stop and look at things differently.
Don't you think that's harder to do now than it used to be because technology allows you to be so connected and get so much information that you're never, off the clock?
Yeah, I think it almost goes back to the human instincts, right? We tend to respond to stimuli. So that buzz in our pocket, oh my gosh, I've got to answer that. No, you don't. No, you don't. In fact, in my voicemail, it says, thank you for your call, and I'll call you back within 3 hours. And they appreciate that kind of commitment. But one of the disciplines, literally, you can actually practice is to put the cell phone away and learn what I call it intentional quiet. When you think about it, it's a critical leadership discipline. The ability to create quiet around yourself is so necessary, and nobody's going to give you permission to do it. You have to be committed to want to do it.
And the book is called The Leader's Climb. It's a business tale about leadership and how to deal with that and be a better leader. And Paul, folks would like to get the book, learn more about the book. Do you have a website or where can they find it?
Yeah, the website, theleadersclimb.com, make that easy. It's also available here in Cincinnati at Joseph Beth and, of course, online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Paul Hagen. Paul is the co-author of The Leader's Climb, a business tale of rising to the new leadership challenge. And Paul, you co-authored this book with another business coach, Bob Parsenko. And what was your intent in writing this book? I mean, there's a lot of business books out there. This one, though, kind of tells a story, and it looks like it's a pretty easy read for somebody maybe sitting on an airplane or sitting on their porch.
That was an important decision. Frankly, I'm kind of a hopeless, I'm a serial storyteller. I just love stories and the power of stories, and I like to write that way. So it was a little bit of that going on, frankly, the frustrated author. But we also chose a story for that very reason. It's just there's something about a story and the texture and the pace. It makes you want to go through it. A lot of people have just poured a glass of wine or a cup of coffee, sat on the back porch or sat on an airplane and read the book all the way through because it kind of pulls you through. But we wanted people to really feel what we're talking about, not just read it abstractly and try and figure out how to apply it. So the book gets into everything from his business and his direct reports, the board of directors, his wife, his son, the handyman in the backyard. I mean, it just really gets into what our lives really are.
So you really get to know the character. Yeah, in all different ways.
And it's like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. The audience always knows what's going to happen. The person on screen is the last person to know. And yes, people are kind of going to the main character, Adam, don't you get it? Didn't you just hear what he just said? And that's what's really fun. That's what engages a reader when they feel like they're getting into the story themselves and starting to think, what would I do in that situation? That's what's so great about it.
But there are real takeaways in the book, aren't there? There are real leadership takeaways that people can gain by just enjoying a nice story.
Our whole premise was people are going so fast today. And as a result, they're forcing decisions, they're fighting too much. And the whole purpose, the message is, one is awareness. Stop. Slow down. Become more aware. And we always say stop thinking but sense, which means take in what you don't know without judgment. But that's a critical discipline today. The second thing is acceptance. Realize that you don't have to fight everything. Some things you ought to just accept for what they are, including, frankly, your own weaknesses sometimes. Just realize what they are. And the third one is abundance. We just, for fun, let's keep the A's going here. But abundance is every time you think, I have no choice, it's got to be this or that, either or, it hardly ever is. That's the time you want to broaden and say, wait a minute, let me create more choices for myself. Because in an abundance of choices, we believe is a better decision.
That's interesting because I've been hearing a lot about this scarcity of thought versus abundance of thought. Is that something that business coaches are talking to people about a lot these days? Why is that out there right now?
I think it's because of speed. People feel, I've got to make a decision because why? Because I got to move on to the next decision. Not I have to make this decision because this is the right time to make it. How many of us wake up after a good night's sleep and go head slap and say, oh, I just thought of something else I could be doing? And that's what the book is really saying. That's the value of slowing down. It really opens up all that stuff. Making a decision, that binary yes or no, is nothing more than a function of feeling pressured for time. I got to make this decision now. And we invariably make bad decisions when we make them in a hurry.
What advice do you have to people, and or they have to go buy the book to get the advice?
Well, yeah, certainly buy the book, only because it's really fun to see how this character dealt with this in very real ways. Again, with his wife, with his son, with the board of directors. This guy was under some very legitimate business pressure. You step back and you kind of go, God, you're right. When he slowed down, he made much better decisions. He was much more effective as a leader. So it's a practiced effort.
Very good advice. Very good book. Again, it's a simple read. It's less than 200 pages. And if folks would like to pick up The Leader's Climb, Paul, where is it at?
It's locally here in Cincinnati. It's at Joseph Beth, and of course online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Ken Racton. Ken is the Interim Executive Director for Senior Services of Northern Kentucky. And Ken, you know, our population is aging. As much as I hate to admit this, I'm aging right along with the rest of the population. But that's bringing challenges. It's making society think differently. And certainly, when you look back at the last few years, some of the folks that really were hurt in the downsizing were part of the baby boomer generation, people about my age. What's happening, and how do you suggest that we as a society deal with this aging population?
You know, and it's interesting to note that Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce identifies that there's going to be a growing need for workers into the future, and that we're going to need to tap this population, my population, the 60 plus, in order to fill that need for workers. As someone enters this time of life, they begin to become circumspect and think about, what am I going to do? In retirement, no longer is a 10 or 15 year period. Retirement can be 30 years. Filling that time with gainful employment or activities that speak to the heart or meaningful service, purposeful activities, is something that we can address as a community. And I believe that we really can address those issues, and we can really begin to talk about that population and how they can be better integrated into society. During the recession, I was one that lost my position at a small bank in Northern Kentucky as a commercial lender. Typically, the oldest with the longest tooth and the highest salary ends up being cut. And that's the way the economy works. I was very fortunate within 9 months to get back into the workforce and find something that was purposeful and meaningful for me at 62 years old to be doing something that I really feel passionate about and I enjoy. And I think those opportunities are out there for others as well. It's going to take two things. It's going to take the employee to understand retooling and how to get back in a call to introspection about what they want to do with the remainder of life. The other thing, on the other side, it's going to take the employer to understand that there's certain services this gray-haired population and certain talents this gray-haired population brings to the table that are not available in other demographics.
Well, you know, some people argue they don't want to hire older people because there's a shorter remaining career. But really, with millennials, I think I read that they're expected to change jobs on average 14 times during their career.
Wow.
So that's not a very long career either.
It is not. That's a good point. Interestingly, too, we will at 65, any employer out there, we will come off of your health care benefit system, you know, at that age, mm-hmm. because we'll move on to Medicare. So there are certain financial advantages to employer in.
You know, don't you think there's just big lessons to be learned there? I mean, as people who are younger than this population that we're talking about today, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, I don't think. I really believe that you just don't have one job that you think you're going to be able to earn money from the rest of your life.
And the other thing that I think they should realize is that there are skill sets that you learn that are transferable to other jobs, and not to get locked in and feel like you can only do one thing.
Well, that's what I was just going to bring up. I mean, you were a banker.
Yeah.
Now you're an executive director of a not-for-profit organization, but I'm sure you use a lot of the things that you learned during your banking career in your leadership and management position.
Yeah, that's very true, Tom. Yeah.
If folks would like to learn more about the Northern Kentucky Senior Services, Kim, what's your website?
Our website is www.seniorservicesnky.org, or you can call the agency at 859-491-0522.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Mary Horbert. Mary is the Community Outreach Coordinator for Lifespan Credit Counseling Services. And Mary, the year is fresh again. 2013 is here, but a lot of folks are finding themselves with just too much debt, including students who may have borrowed money to go to college. What do you say to people who just feel overwhelmed with debt?
Well, overwhelmed with credit card debt, they can negotiate with their own credit card companies. They will help them. But understand, when you negotiate with a credit card company or you come to a reputable credit counseling service, you will stop using your credit cards. Students or graduates who find themselves with jobs or no job or a job that will not pay them enough to repay their student loans. First of all, they should be working on some type of budget to try to repay it. But there are repayment options today that were not available before, and they need to explore those. They need to go to the websites. They need to go back to their colleges and find out what they can possibly do. And there are special programs. There are income-based programs where you will only pay a percentage of your income for 20, 25 years. If you work for a nonprofit organization or a state organization, government office, if you can make on-time payments for 10 years, they may forgive part of your loan. So there are more options available. Graduates don't know about them. And one mistake that they're also making is just ignoring the notices. They have 6 to 9 months to start repaying their student loans. They get those notices and they just go, well, gee, I'm not making enough money to pay this. They need to get forbearances or
deferments
for their student loans. They need to address these issues because they don't go away. These are government loans. They're not going to be able to include them in a bankruptcy. This is debt they absolutely have to deal with.
And you know, Mary, I think a lot of people make the mistake as their students or parents on behalf of their students that they borrow too much money for college. It might make economic sense to borrow money for a college education, but I think you want to keep the borrowing as low as you can in order to avoid these future problems of paying off the loans.
You absolutely need to keep the borrowing as low as you can. And make sure you're only borrowing for your education and not so you can buy a car and have a car.
Fun or vacations.
Go on vacations. I know people who've done that. Living expenses, that type of thing. The other thing is you don't need to go to the college that costs the most money if you're going to go into a profession that doesn't pay a lot of money. So if you're studying to be a CPA and you expect to be successful, you can borrow more money than if you're going to school to be, for instance, a medical assistant or a social worker or a teacher. Those are great professions, but they don't pay a lot of money.
You know, you want to have your child go after their dreams and go to the school they want to, but there really needs to be a reality check in terms of what something costs in terms of tuition versus the return on that investment.
And that's exactly how students need to look at it. And unfortunately, a few years ago, we didn't look at it that way. It was the college experience. My child needs to go where he or she wants to go. That type of thing. Today, you're right. We need to look at it as return on investment.
And if individuals listening today would like to contact you, what's your contact information?
Just call me directly. My line is 513-476-6096.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.